Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
Next stop, Lunch with Leon from itthub.net.
And welcome to Lunch with Leon. This week, we're having a transatlantic lunch as one of my guests was in California and the other in UK. I was with D-Risk, who are doing some amazing things for autonomous vehicles. Joining me from the USA is Chez Stetson, the chief executive at D-Risk, and from UK, Rav Babra, who is the business development and program manager. I started by asking them what they do.
So we have been tasked by the UK's Centre for Connected Autonomous Vehicles, along with our consortium members, to build the ultimate driver's test for the self-driving car. We are a small company, and we all also work in concert with the consortium. And we have been building this test, which should really allow us to determine when AVs can be safer, not just safer than humans, but many times safer than humans. And we now have this test available, and we are using it in a variety of different ways right now with current AV technologies to figure out how we can basically get to a vision zero, not just within London, but around the globe, get losses down to zero as quickly as possible using the right combination of autonomous vehicle and ADAS technologies.
So that's really interesting, because it's an argument I've frequently had here in the UK and indeed elsewhere in the world, because it has always struck me that autonomous vehicles will be very much safer than humans driving vehicles. But one of the problems is that whilst they'll be many times safer, it will be quite hard to get to zero, and there will be people who are killed or seriously injured by autonomous vehicles, but there'll be very much fewer of them. You know, here in the UK, we kill 3 or 4 people a day with manually driven vehicles. So autonomous vehicles have got to be better than that, and they've got to be nearly zero. Is that fair?
I think let's keep it there. Epsilon towards zero.
Yeah. Because, and that's one of the things, it seems to me, the critics of autonomous vehicles, and we have a number of them here in the UK, talk about things in a particular sort of way. They talk about how it won't be possible, it'll be too difficult, about all the things we know about identifying others, the movements of others, predicting the movements of others, and so on. But they never mention the fact that these human drivers that we have here every day are killing, in the UK, 1,500 people a year. And here in the UK, and I think in the US too, frankly, people killed and seriously injured on the roads is just the price of commerce and freedom and life, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I suppose we've got there, but I don't think one should be too hard on oneself if you're in Britain, because you can tell I'm not British by upbringing from my accent. But the reason that I happen to be working with our team, D-Risk, in Britain is because you have a much more holistic approach to safety than most other places. And specifically with regard to autonomous vehicles, we've decided to actually come up with a great test, which we're not quite doing right now in the United States. And it's precisely because Britain has got, I would say, a world-leading vision towards Vision Zero. So while I agree with what you said, don't be too hard on yourselves. I mean, at least you're not driving in Los Angeles.
Indeed. So tell us some more then about what D-Risk does and how it's going to contribute to this.
I'll take that one then, Chess. So D-Risk are creating a driving test for autonomous vehicles, and we've got a mandate from UK government sponsored by CCAV. They're called the Centre for Connected and Autonomous Vehicles. And we're making this driving test, which the DVLA or the DVSA could use when an autonomous vehicle company turns up to the UK and says, look, we've got this brilliant car, we've tested it, it won't kill anyone. How will they have confidence in it being safe, secure, and doing what it says on the tin? We have an API that we've designed and generated, and we are able to supply that autonomous vehicle stack, or the brain of the autonomous vehicle, test cases. Now, cast your mind back to your driving test. It very much depended on time of day, which vehicle you were doing on it, doing the test in, which environment you were doing it in. So for example, London might be a difficult place to conduct a driving test and take a driving test, and it may be fathoms harder to pass a driving test in London, whereas out where I live in Marlborough and Wiltshire in the sticks, you know, you just pass a couple of tractors and you've passed. What we're doing is we are catching edge cases. So we are using various sources of data, including 1,000 cameras, CCTV cameras called the Jamcam network dotted in and around London. We're monitoring them. We're capturing edge cases, we call them, which are high risk incidents taking place. We recreate those in our simulation environment, and we are able to present the autonomous vehicle brain with those high risk scenarios to see what it will do. Will it crash into the child that we've got running out from behind the ice cream, or will it stop in time? And that should give the DVLA, DVSA, and any other governing body around the world confidence that that autonomous vehicle will not kill people.
And that's really interesting. Now, one of the things that comes as part of that, it's often posed as a test question about whether the artificial intelligence will choose between the old person, the middle-aged person, or the child on the basis that it's been taught that, for example, the economic value of an elderly person is lower and therefore could be sacrificed if there had to be a choice. Now, that's all Big Brother stuff, but that's not really what the AI is taught, is it?
Not at all, Leon. So the autonomous vehicle is never taught the value of a person. It's told that there is a person, but that's all it will do. Now, the answer that I would give is that if the vehicle gets into a situation in which that it has to choose between two people, it wouldn't ever make that decision. In fact, it's gone too far. It should never have got itself in that situation to start with. So it would either have slowed down way back because it knew that there is possible risk up ahead. It just wouldn't get into that sort of situation. We affectionately known this as it's called the trolley problem. This one always comes up when I tell people where I work.
Yes, it is interesting. Just to sort of push that on a bit further. So what we're talking about is situations. What about those cases where things resemble humans? So can it tell the difference, for example, between a real warm body and a dummy?
Well, look, if you had an autonomous vehicle and you stuck a dummy out in the street just in front of it, you'd want it to stop too, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. So what we're talking about, what I'm trying to deal with here are the things that others bring forward, which in many cases are just distractions and are meant to be somewhere between a criticism and humorous to try and deflect us from the path, which I think we're following. And it seems to me the path that we're following is also the route to autonomous vehicles is progressive, isn't it? I mean, there will be more automation and more automation. So all the users will get used to it. The drivers will get used to it. The pedestrians will get used to it. Other road users will get used to it. And it is progressive, isn't it? It's not like we're heading for some sort of overnight change from manually driven vehicles to autonomous vehicles.
I think you're very likely correct. And part of that transition is what DRISC are also trying to facilitate at the moment, because what you've got is the potential to be using really effective autonomous technologies in the context of normal human drivers just now. And you can have lane keeping, of course, you can have automatic emergency braking, you can have these things. These things are put into new vehicles all the time, but they can also be in some sense bolt on to existing commercial vehicles. And what we want to do is find the way to target these technologies so that we're reducing losses now, as opposed to just waiting for kind of everything to evolve.
Sure. Now that makes sense. In fact, anybody that's bought a modern vehicle recently will have lane keeping assist and will have automatic emergency braking and so on. So those features are already arriving. And the other one, interested to hear your views on, one of the reasons why vehicles and pedestrians are separated is for safety. But if we take the autonomous vehicle line far enough, then actually separating them in that way will no longer be quite so necessary. So for example, and here's a ridiculous example, a zero emission autonomous vehicle could move safely inside a building in the same way that it moves safely outside a building, couldn't it?
I'm guessing it's certainly possible, Leon, but it depends. Inside a building, I see a vision of a Ford Granada moving around the inside of a building. I'm guessing it's not quite that. We'll be talking about perhaps a pod or something, maybe like a robo-taxi that could deliver you directly to your desk. but certainly some infrastructure changes are needed, especially in old cities like London.
Yeah, I guess I'm just interested as to whether the sort of conventional separation for road vehicles would be as important with autonomous vehicles, because they could coexist more easily than currently.
One rough area in current driving and is cyclists. Cyclists and drivers never get on, and there is a reason for that. It's cyclists can cause issues of seeing around or cycling side by side, etc. But AVs would probably be able to negotiate their way around them or wait patiently. There isn't that pressure for time there. So certainly that coexistence could be better.
Okay. So then let's take us back to the mainstream, which I think is where you're doing quite a lot of work then for at the moment, which is that you are picking out from real life situations, you are detecting cases that were potentially difficult for any road user to deal with, and you are making sure that those situations are being absorbed into the artificial intelligence that drive autonomous vehicles. So their ability to avoid those particular sorts of cases and deal with them is enhanced. And in order to prove to any statutory authority that might be involved that the vehicles concerned are already proof against those types of incidents taking place. So in the same way, a human driver is tested to see if they display the right characteristics in the right circumstances, that's what your software does too.
And actually, you predicted something there that, not everybody gets to this leap, but you can not only test them, but you can use the same test to improve them. I suppose we sort of do that with our driving tests ourselves, but you can do that at a much greater speed with an autonomous vehicle. We call it reinforcement learning. So we can do both. We can test how effective they are, and we can provide the test in such a way that they can actually get better, while at the same time holding out a whole bunch of test cases that they haven't seen yet to make sure it's still a good test when the final assessment comes.
Oh, I see. So in fact, it's like a sort of self-calibrating mechanism where as it learns more and more things and learns to deal with those things more expertly, it has learned in the process as you then continue to introduce other situations to it.
Yes. And that's part of the big promise. That's one of the reasons why we do believe strongly that the industry can get to very nearly zero or almost epsilon zero, as we were talking about before, because it does have the possibility for continuous improvement. If you can establish the basis set, as we might call it.
So where do you see this first starting to arrive? And I didn't say when, but I don't mean geographically where, but do we expect autonomous vehicles to first exist in the car space, the taxi space, the truck space? Where would you see autonomous vehicles first making themselves obvious?
We're seeing proliferation of autonomous technology in the trucking industry in the United States, first and foremost. It's called Category 8 trucking. It's basically what we call HGV or tractor trailer type HGV goods movement, hub to hub in the United States. And of course, they've got long roads with not very much on, with hubs outside of the main cities. So they're able to use this autonomous technology. There are a few companies that are really pushing the boundaries now, which we are already talking to. We're in conversation with a few companies, but it's hub-to-hub trucking where we first will start to see full automation.
Is it right then that if it starts, for example, in trucking, then the database of information about behaviours and so on will grow exponentially because systems will be recording phenomenal amounts of data in the way in which situations have arisen and reactions have taken place. So this is for this will just blossom out into better calibrated autonomous vehicles internationally?
So I think a lot of people would agree with that, but we think it's possible to do even better than that. So you can record hundreds of miles, I should say millions of miles of data, hundreds of thousands of hours of data from cameras, from dash cams on a truck, from CCTVs dotted all around a particular route. And you're right, the proliferation of data will increase, but most of it will just be born, especially if it's on the route, you know, US 10 between San Diego and Dallas, one that I've driven many times. It's pretty boring. What you really need to do is predict what's going to happen not just what has already happened. And what you want now are autonomous vehicles that could deal with, you know, a low-flying plane, a level crossing, and a guy in a chicken suit, right? Any human could deal with that situation. We can present those situations to autonomous vehicles now, even before all the data has proliferated, as you say, because we can use previous data to predict future data. We can predict how likely that occurrence is, and not just how likely it is, but how representative it is of other possible tests we might want to do. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. It's not just about recording existing data, although that's a huge part of it. It's about predicting what's going to happen, not just what has already happened. And we can actually do that now. It's really a question of, can the autonomous vehicle industry get its head around testing comprehensively versus what they've been sort of doing so far, which is testing in an ad hoc way.
So that's interesting. So I'm reading this back because as an older person, I need to understand this slowly. So firstly, you're telling us that, in fact, the systems are clever enough to predict without infinite amounts of data from previous events because the learning capacity is so strong. Is that right?
I might be brassy enough to say that a de-risked system is clever enough to predict those. We can test the AV systems on them. And that's really what the rhythm right breakdown is. You need a tester, you need testing and training data that is comprehensive enough to be able to feed it all to you. Make sure that you're not over testing in one region and under testing in another region. And then you need an autonomous vehicle system, which will very likely have some learned features, some deep learning in the background that is, as you say, de facto predicting those things. It might see we might present, for example, a child walking across the street dressed as a green traffic light, you know, for Halloween as a particularly tricky scenario. Now, that AV may never have seen it before. It may not recognize that it's looking at a child dressed as a green traffic light. It may not have predicted it, but it should be able to handle it. It should not misinterpret that green traffic light as a sign to go. It should recognize that it's looking at a little person buried inside a costume.
Fascinating.
At the very minimum, something it just shouldn't go into.
Brought to you by ITTHub.net. Check out our newsfeed for all the latest, plus details of this and all our other podcast features.
And does this go hand in hand with what a colleague of mine calls naked highways, which is removing the traffic lights and the signage and stuff from the highways? It'll be inboard anyway. If for a human-driven vehicle, it'll be inside the vehicle, inside the systems. And presumably then for an autonomous vehicle, it's known instinctively. Am I on the right track?
Certainly possible, Leon. So we've got both things at the moment called CAV and CAM. So connected and autonomous vehicles and connected and autonomous mobility. These are vehicles talking to the infrastructure around them. So things like traffic lights could be represented inside a vehicle, traffic signs, signage, etc. All could just appear inside the vehicle and no need for it to be outside. But of course, you've got the likes of me, old fogies that like their classic cars. So I'm not about to let go of my year 2000 Porsche Boxster anytime soon. So I hope to be able to use that for the next 40 years. So
wait, that's a classic car, is it, Rav?
I guess it's not a 1950s
MG or something. I thought.
Well, it is 20 years old now. It is 20 years old. But I guess for the short space of time, we probably still will still see traffic signs and traffic lights, etc. But potentially in the future, they could disappear.
Well, look, I have a 1950s bus and I need to be able to drive that too. So I'm with you in terms of making sure that we still have roads that we can drive our classic vehicles on. So what else is DRISC up to then that will be of interest? Because this is clearly huge artificial intelligence capability. So am I right in thinking you've been doing some work for COVID?
Yes, indeed. You're right, Leon. So we were approached by Innovate UK recently, who we have our £3 million grant from. And they asked us if there was anything we could repurpose in terms of our technology to help fight the current pandemic. We looked at our object detection, which has been trained on the detection of vehicles and their behavior as seen on the jam cams. We were able to repurpose that. So our engineering team repurposed that to look and count pedestrians and vehicle movement. And we've been able to use those open source TfL jam cams to look in and around London and count people and vehicles. And we are able to plot those on a histogram to see things like the effects of lockdown, the effects of the release of lockdown, the shopping weekend just prior to Christmas was a big spike on the graph. And further, we're able to monitor social distancing. So we've drawn hula hoops, artificial hula hoops around people's midriffs at 1 meter of diameter. When they get too close to one another, they're highlighted. So potentially a council or a local authority could use this to check whether things like the barriers, artificial barriers that they place to encourage pavement widening or spaces for tables for cafe are working or not. And we've also done some analysis of junctions and pedestrian crossings to show that people are potentially waiting at Pelican crossings by pressing the button and waiting next to somebody for 3 minutes. And we've been able to advise councils that perhaps if change that to 30 seconds or 40 seconds, it will stop people having to stand next to each other at the pavement within quite a tight distance to each other. So we've been marketing a product there around social distancing. It's called the De-Risk COVID Social Distancing Toolbox, and that's available to see on our website. And further to that, we've also done some work around route risk analysis, which I hope Chess can talk about.
Certainly. Well, so as I think you can tell, Leon, it's all about understanding risks. Now, at the moment, it's COVID risks. And we very much, I mean, COVID is really ramped up. And even though we can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel, it's how quickly can we get there and with how little excess death. And so just to continue to plug what Rav was talking about, any borough councils, city councils, county councils that are interested in using this system right now in order to ameliorate social distancing, measure the effect of interventions, very pleased to talk to you. But also after COVID is over, we can use these same techniques in order to best understand where risk sits on the entire transportation network. Now, we're familiar with this sort of classic story from commercial trucking, where a certain fleet of trucks doesn't take left turns because they in the United States, because they have to sit there waiting at the light with their engines going and the emissions are too great. So they optimized over emissions in order to decide on routes that don't require any left turns. In assessing risk, though, across the great spectrum of not only AV but human risk, we realized that it's possible to reroute vehicles, even human-driven vehicles, to reduce risk. And what if you could reduce your claims, your losses, by 10% over the course of a year? What kind of positive effect would that have, say, if you're a fleet manager, in your ability to get a lower insurance premium, or indeed to just not even pay for the deductibles on those claims, if you like? So this is something that we are trying to optimize for right now. It can include the incorporation of new AV technologies, but fundamentally it's about understanding where the risks are on the road and optimizing for them.
That's interesting. I mean, there's lots of things playing in my mind here. So, for example, when I was at Transport for London and we were doing detailed modeling of traffic movements, it did occur to me as we would make these into visualizations to show to people. We did for the Olympics, we were able to show how the road network would function during the Olympic Games. We were able to demonstrate how the Olympic lanes would get the VIP athletes' vehicles through and so on. And it occurred to me then, wouldn't it be great if the thing that we planned and the instructions that autonomous vehicles received and behaved became one and the same thing? So effectively the planning and the output was exactly the same, because there's a feedback loop there, isn't there? The traffic behaves in a certain sort of way, that data is collected, that data can be fed into the planning tools for everything, for the adjustment of traffic signals, changing of road layouts, pedestrian crossings, banned left and right turns, and so on. So eventually the planning and the execution is seamless, and that has to be a dream, doesn't it?
It's a brilliant vision. But I don't think we even need to wait for the ultimate autonomous vehicle to start achieving it, is I think is what we're on about, if you will. Transport for London is a great example. London, while no death is acceptable, London deaths have been going down because of the kind of planning that you just described. What if we could use AI techniques to automate that, federate it for as many places as possible, hand it to fleets, hand it to, that's the sort of thing that we are proposing to sort of do here, so that we don't need to wait for autonomous vehicles. We can use semi-autonomous technologies, or just the same kinds of data science and AI techniques that we use in order to come up with those autonomous technologies to continue to reduce the risk across the board.
So, Jez, I'm just going to take you and Rav away from the science for a moment, because I know everybody who's listening to this is already convinced by the science. But I'm also interested in the public behaviors. So, for example, we are now running autonomous vehicles. We've got a much improved safety record. We're running on conventional streets. So when I press the button to cross the street, am I going to wait for 60 seconds or 90 seconds to cross the street? Or am I going to walk out in front of your autonomous vehicle because I know it's going to stop for me?
That's a fantastic question. It depends, I guess, Leon, how much you value your own life. Or maybe that's the wrong answer.
It depends on whether it's been trained on D-Risk's library or not, is what it depends on. It should just have a big old sign on the front of it that says D-Risk. Yeah. And if it says D-Risk on the front of it, you know you're good.
You can step out in front of it. And I'll tell you why I'm interested, because autonomous vehicles will have to coexist with people. And even when we are convinced that, as you've described, that the D-Risk solution does ensure a very high level of safety, the highest possible level of safety in avoiding accidents and avoiding collisions and avoiding deaths and serious injuries, which is just magic, it does nevertheless invite people to treat it in a different way. So if I can give you an example, and you talked about cycling and trucking. I had somebody come to me and show me their invention. And their invention was that they were constantly measuring the distance between the truck and objects near them. It could identify cyclists. And if the algorithm spotted there was a propensity to collide because they were getting closer to each other or whatever, it applied the truck's brakes.
Yep.
And I said, I'm not having this. Because you know what will happen? And they said, well, this would be fantastic. I said, no, it won't. As a result of that, the drivers will drive like hell because they know that if they're likely to get near a cyclist, the system will deliver them out of the risk. And I don't want anything giving the individual an excuse for not behaving in a proper manner all the time.
It's a brilliant example.
Yeah.
And it's already happening. The most successful AV deployments in the US have this problem just now, because they deploy it around the city. They get buy-in from the city, but they don't necessarily get buy-in from everybody in the city. And this is another sense in which the D-Risk Consortium are trying to sort of push the bounds on this, or trying to contribute, I guess you might say. So we're part of a group that includes ourselves, Imperial College London, DG Cities, which is based in North Greenwich, and also Claytex, which is a simulation and sensor modeling provider. All very talented people. And one of these entities, DG Cities, has put out a survey on what drivers, human drivers, are going to expect from autonomous vehicles and how they expect to work with them. And we're collecting a huge amount of data on this just now. And in this service, you get to say a bit about what you expect out of AVs, what your hopes and fears are, maybe what happens if they have to deal with a certain kind of scenario, maybe one you've encountered in the past. And we hope that by socializing the expectations for AVs now, countrywide, and countrywide, by of course, I mean, you know, the UK, that we can have a phase in of these things where people treat them with the kind of respect and good expectations of their behavior that we believe is possible, instead of treating them as something to be gained or something to pull in front of and dash your milkshake over the sensors or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, well, you see, I'm fascinated by that because, you see, I'm entirely convinced that the technology will succeed. I have no doubt. It may take a while, but I'm sure the technology will succeed, as technology usually always does. But I've also been interested in exploring the consequences for the humans around the technology, just in the way that we've described, because humans will have to modify their behavior a little in order to deal with this. There'll be some elements of society, as you say, that will enjoy somehow trying to provoke an autonomous piece of technology to fight back or to retaliate or to behave in a certain sort of way. So what's to stop some pedestrian just walking down the street at 4 miles an hour in front of the traffic in the knowledge that the traffic will all just carry on behind it? You know, there's all of those things. But I think where I hope we get to, because if I might say so, the thing that appeals so much to me about the de-risk work and solution is it finally starts to talk about safety in a way that we've not talked about. I don't think we've talked about properly before. We've talked about the technology. We've talked about how clever the technology can be. We've talked about how autonomous vehicles will hand control back to human drivers under certain conditions. We've talked about all of those things. And we've had massive debates, and there are plenty of people with different sorts of motives arguing against it. And in fact, I had a guest on this podcast who said they thought autonomous passenger carrying drones would arrive before autonomous vehicles. Who knows? But what I love about what de-risk is,
but they're not going to achieve, you know, the massive savings that we might expect from autonomous vehicles. I mean, even so, right? What's the is there enough commercial demand for something that uses that much fuel or electricity?
Yeah.
So that questioner may have been right, and yet there's still a big market demand.
Yeah, for sure. But what's impressing me about the de-risk offering is that your whole sell is about safety. That's what's coming through so strongly. And on that basis, anything that is designed to squeeze out the deaths and serious injuries to humans as a result of us moving about on this planet definitely has to be a great step forward. And I think that is such a strong point that I don't think has been adequately made. And one of the reasons I don't think it's made adequately here, of course, is that people are not as outraged by the number of deaths on our roads by human-driven vehicles as they ought to be. Because as we talked about earlier, there's no other walk of life where you'd be allowed to kill that many people in pursuit of commerce, freedom, social behavior, or whatever. You just wouldn't be allowed. So I think this makes extraordinary sense. And then the other thing which I hope I've learned today, and I hope some listeners will enjoy as well, which is that this technology that is capable of identifying different sorts of highway users, including pedestrians, has other applications in everything from keeping us 2 meters apart in order to avoid infecting each other with the coronavirus, to simple other techniques whereby, as we've talked about, the way in which people behave at pedestrian crossings and so on. So I think that's all tremendous. So Rav, tell me about this other product that you have that's really useful for fleet managers.
Yeah, so we've got a product called the Route Risk Assessment Tool, and it's predominantly for fleet managers. So we are looking for fleet managers that we can trial this tool with. Currently, fleet managers would use software tools to plan their drop-off points and their routes, either for time reasons or ease of flow around a city or around the UK. What we're trying to do is put a small piece in there about safety. So we would be able to advise a fleet operator that potentially the A30, for want of a better example, may be a risky road to go down on a certain day under certain weather conditions. So perhaps on those days where the weather is bad, don't go down the A30. You may save some time, but the risk would be far increased on that route on that day for both your load, your driver, and general public. So we're able to give that service also. And what we're looking at is to see, we've got a questionnaire that we'd like to ask fleet managers to complete for us, just to understand how they currently plan safety into their routes. And Leon, if it's okay with you, maybe we could share that link.
Yeah, very happy to do that.
Okay.
And we'll put that link on our website too. So fleet managers who want to take part in that would be very welcome.
And then the other one, Leon, is last but not least, I hope I'm not being greedy. Chess mentioned that the DG Cities team, so Digital Greenwich, are doing our public outreach, and they've currently got a survey live at the moment. And this is all about the public's perception to AVs. I think Chess hinted at it. Again, are we able to put that link somewhere in
there? Yes, please. Yeah. Yeah, no problem.
Fantastic. Chess, anything else that you would like to add?
back on the topic of rat risk assessment, you know, to the extent that fleet managers are interested in taking advantage of AV technologies, bolt on or new, we're very interested in engaging with fleet managers to figure out how to reduce losses. And we do have a toolbox incorporating both rat risk assessment and AV products that we believe can achieve that. And we've shown that we can achieve, in some cases, better than 10% loss reduction. So please do, don't hesitate to reach out to us. AVs are maybe in the future in the limit, but we can use AV technology right now to our benefit.
That's great, thank you. So I've been talking today to Chez Stetson and Rav Babra from DRISC. You can find out all about DRISC over on their website, which is drisc.ai. This has been Lunch with Leon, which is an ITTHub.net production. We've had a great time today talking about the consequences and the developments for autonomous vehicles. I'm really grateful to Chez and Rav for being on the show. Chez has joined us from Pasadena, where it's very much earlier in the day than it is for Rav and I in the UK. But I've really enjoyed having them as my guests for lunch today. And I look forward to seeing you next time.
Brilliant. Thank you, Leon.
Thanks, Leon.